Part 1. The Mission. 1. Shorty, perched on the A-frame ladder with six colors of paint and half-cut beer cans jostling on the top step as he worked the brush against the riveted aircraft hull. It was late afternoon on a rare sunny day in Thurgood, but the olive-painted aluminum was still cool and taking the paint well. The long fuselage of the B-17F Flying Fortress slanted down to Shorty's right, shadows stretching onto the recently constructed concrete taxiway. The number two engine propeller was a huge Y behind him.
Her tits are too small.
Shorty looked down to see Gus Garrett squinting up at him, blue eyes and a work-tanned face, hair the color of corn silk. A worn ball glove hung on his left hand.
Too small for what? Shorty asked.
Garrett grinned.
For me, for starters.
Shorty shook his head sadly.
You just remember them bigger,
he said in Jack Benny's instantly recognizable voice.
Because you haven't seen any in so long, you know?
I wanted them bigger then, too,
said Garrett, and turned back to the game of catch going on around the bomber parked on its hardstand. Shorty shook his head and went back to work painting the nose art. He'd already drawn the shape in chalk and then painted in the face, the flesh tones, the blue leotard, the gauzy windblown cape. Flesh tones were hard, but at least he was working with oils thanks to Corporal Brinkman's run into town for more art supplies. Sunny days in June seemed about as common as rocking horse shit here in southeastern England. Shorty was squeezing everything he could out of it, but soon he'd be losing the sunlight, and he still had to do the black ink outlines and final highlights that would make the whole thing pop and give it life. Below him, someone cleared his throat and spat. Shorty looked down to see Flight Engineer Wendell Boniker squinting up at the painting in progress. Wen was a beefy, sandy-haired guy who was always looking at things as if he were trying to figure out how to fix them, people included. 4 years ago, he'd quit high school to run moonshine outside of Charlotte, and he'd outrun feds and sheriffs on endless miles of winding country road in cars he'd built and modified and repaired since he'd been old enough to reach the pedals. Wen claimed he could drive or fix anything with wheels on it, and given the magic he worked on a ship, no one had any reason to doubt him.
That farm boy getting in your hair?
Wen called up. Shorty wiped his forehead with the arm holding the brush.
Says her tits are too small.
Shit,
said Wen. He raised his voice.
That tractor jockey never saw tits on nothing he didn't have to milk at 5 a.m.
Shorty grinned and turned back to his painting.
Legs could be longer, though, Wen added.
Shorty sagged.
For crying in the sink,
he said. He glared over his shoulder and shook the brush at Wen. In Jack Benny's voice, he said,
Don't you have a ball to throw, Cinderella?
Wen smirked.
Man, you arty types sure are touchy.
He touched the bill of his worn A3 cap and spat tobacco juice and went to rejoin the game of catch. The crew liked to go out to the bomber and throw the ball around after chow. It let them blow off steam and bitch about the army and insult each other without it getting too personal. It worked pretty well. Today they had another reason for their ritual game of catch. The B-17F heavy bomber that Shorty was painting was brand new, delivered the day before yesterday, and parked on a hard stand in the slot the much-reviled Voice of America had occupied for half a dozen straight missions. At the moment, the new bird was just a number, unchristened and untested. And even though her delivery had also been her shakedown cruise, and she'd been checked out on arrival, and would be gone over again by the ground crew if Ordnance got the go-ahead tonight, Wen had told Captain Farley that a little tire-kicking session might be a good idea. Farley had agreed. This was one of the world's most complicated machines, about to be loaded with 4 tons of coiled death and thrown into the sky with 10 young men who squabbled like close brothers, even though they had been strangers to each other the year before, and schoolboys the year before that. A successful mission and those 10 lives could turn on a tightened oil gasket, a correctly loaded ammo belt, or any of the 10,000 other things that could go graveyard wrong. When that huge and intricate web could be undone at almost any strand, you bought yourself whatever insurance you could.
So today's game of catch served as a smokescreen to let the crew check out the ground crew's work without looking as if they didn't trust the ground crew. Because you had to trust the ground crew. The alternative was to worry that one link in that chain had not been done right and go completely out of your mind. And the crew couldn't afford that, because doing their own jobs right could drive them foxhole crazy if they thought too much about what they were doing. USAAF hospitals were full to bursting with promising young men who had looked too long and too hard into the wholesale abattoir that was the new science of aerial warfare. Human brains might have invented it, but they sure as hell weren't built to endure it. As Lieutenant Brobin put it, going daffy was the only reasonable thing a man could do in these conditions. Somewhere behind Shorty, a ball clapped into a leather glove, and someone shouted a friendly insult. Shorty could listen to it all day. It sounded like home. Every so often, one of the men would take off his ball glove and jump up into the main hatch of the bomber. Sometimes the crew heard banging from inside, sometimes swearing. They ignored both. They played catch and smoked cigarettes, or, in Boney Mullen's case, a pipe. A few minutes later, the missing crewman would hop back down to the concrete and put his glove back on and quietly rejoin the game, and the ball would come his way and he'd give a little nod. At one point, Shorty heard Plavitz yelling up at him, and he patiently finished painting a section and turned around to see the navigator shaking a finger up at him.
"What are you doing with my sticks?" he demanded.
"Simmer down, Gene Krupa," Shorty said. "I saw them laying around, and I knew you'd blow a gasket if they turned up missing, so I grabbed them. Here."
He drew Plavitz's hickory drumsticks from a rear pocket and tossed them down. Plavitz caught them up and twirled them in the same fluid motion.
"I never," he said.
"You're welcome, I'm sure,"
Shorty said in Bugs Bunny's voice and turned back to the painting taking shape before him.
"Yeah, okay. Thanks," said Plavitz, and disappeared into the bomber.
A moment later, rapid-fire rolls and lazy paradiddles sounded from different parts of the aircraft. Shorty mixed paints on a page torn from an old Yank magazine and leaned back to study the figure he was forming on the metal. He dipped his brush in a sheared beer can of black paint and pulled the wet bristles between his thumb and forefinger several times, testing the flow. Then he got to work on the black lines, starting with the legs, which were bare from ankle-strap-high heels all the long way to the dark blue leotard at her pelvis. They were plenty long enough, thank you very much. The drumming stopped and Plavitz hopped out of the aircraft. "It's still got that new bomber smell," he announced. Shorty made a pained face.
"Your parents must be some very patient people," he said. "Or deaf."
Plavitz twirled a stick like a majorette.
"You'll be laughing when I'm playing with Glenn Miller," he said, and hurried to rejoin the game of catch.
Shorty shook his head. Plavitz was okay, except when he wasn't. Shorty's father, Howard Dubuque, owned a radio sales and service shop in downtown Granville, Michigan. Little Wayne had grown up surrounded by radios and radio programs. He had learned to tell time by what show was on the air. In fifth grade, he had built his first wireless radio with a piece of Galena crystal and a safety pin. And he still remembered the thrill of hearing Fibber McGee's voice come over a speaker he had salvaged from a busted radio. As he grew older, he helped his father in the shop, troubleshooting ornate Gothic Hartcos, arched Philco cathedrals, cheap Sears Bakelite silver tones. Eventually, Wayne had his own little corner in the shop's back room. He'd repair the electronics, polish the wood with lemon oil, clean the Bakelite with dish soap. A Dubuque repair was good as new, and loyal customers and strong word of mouth helped carry Wayne's family through the Great Depression. When Wayne's father asked him to spruce up the store's faded signage, Wayne went ahead and made all new signs. He had a knack for drawing, and soon half the stores along First Street sported Wayne's lettering and artwork. Often he worked in trade for groceries or dry goods. One time, even a month of free tickets at the Paramount. Eventually, Wayne became a ham radio operator, driving his mother crazy with the constant,
"CQ, CQ, this is Granville, Michigan, USA, come in." that came from his bedroom. She would chase him out of the house, laughing and saying, "Why can't you hang out on street corners like other boys your age?" Radio operator was an ironclad cinch for Wayne after basic. His knowledge and experience pretty much guaranteed a slot on a bomber roster. And flying with the new Army Air Force and all that Buck Rogers gear was the cat's meow to the newly minted Private First Class Dubuque. After pre-flight training, he was sent to Scott Field in Illinois for radio operator training. Wayne aced Morse code, but he was surprised how much more than radio he was supposed to learn. Basic navigation, aircraft identification, gunnery, oxygen mask systems, generators, and radios, too, more intimately than even he could have imagined. By the end of training, Wayne could assemble an aircraft radio by feel in a pitch-black room. He'd been promoted to sergeant. All bomber crew were sergeant or higher, so they'd be treated better if they were captured, and assigned to a B-17 crew under Captain Logan at Maxwell Field, Alabama. When the crew found out his hobby was shortwave radio, Wayne was Shorty from then on. When they found out he could draw, Captain Logan asked him to do the nose art for their new bomber, which he was calling Voice of America. Shorty painted a towering Uncle Sam shouting bombs through a megaphone at a cowering Hitler. And now here he was, on the other side of the Atlantic, and Captain Logan had been killed by flak over Cologne, and Shorty was painting a new bird for a different pilot. Life worked out funny, when it worked out at all. Shorty finished the black lines and stepped up a rung on the folding ladder and set a hand on the hull. He worked on the face again, adding contour and highlights, color to the cheeks.
"Hey, Shorty,"
a voice behind him called in a thick New Jersey accent.
"How come you didn't make that little number look like Francis's sister?"
Then a long, low whistle and a few laughs from below. Shorty turned to see Lieutenant Brobin sitting on the number 2 engine cowling. The co-pilot lit a Lucky and gestured with it.
"That girl's a blue plate special."
"Oh, jeez, Lieutenant,"
said Francis, whom Brobin had instantly dubbed St. Francis because he was pure as angel piss.
"I don't even have a sister."
"Whose picture were you showing these deprived apes the other day?" Brobin demanded. "Your Sunday school teacher?"
Francis colored. He shaved once a month and had lied about his age when he'd joined up, and if anyone was going to get out of this war still a virgin, it was him.
"Gosh," he said, "that was my mom. She does teach Sunday school, though."
"That dame was your mother?"
Robin looked up at the clouds.
"I wouldn't show these saps a picture of my great-grandma. They get worked up when they see an overstuffed couch."
"You should make her look like Francis's mom," Plavitz called up. "It's good luck to have the mother of a saint on your bomber."
The others laughed.
"The captain was pretty definite what he wanted her to look like," Shorty said.
In fact, over beer in the boiler room the other night, Captain Farley had gone into great detail about the girl he wanted on their bomber, nodding more and more enthusiastically as Shorty sketched on napkin after napkin, zeroing in on the face the captain wanted. Shorty had wondered why the captain didn't have a picture if the girl meant so much to him, but you didn't ask about that stuff. Whoever she was, Shorty wanted to do her justice. Brobin kicked his feet between the prop blades.
"You're gonna be painting her by moonlight if you don't hurry up," he said.
"It'd go a lot quicker if everyone stopped giving me their expert opinion."
Brobin spread his hands.
"Everyone's an expert on dames. Well, you can have her fast, or you can have her good."
The lieutenant grinned.
"Like I said."
"Why can't they be both?"
asked Garrett. Brobin ignored him.
"She's kind of pale, ain't she?"
he asked. Shorty didn't bother to look back at him.
"Do I look like Michelangelo to you, Lieutenant?"
"Well," a mild voice said, "you're painting on top of a ladder, and you're taking orders from God." They all turned to see Captain Farley standing with his hands on his hips, his crushed cap raked back on his head as he looked up at the nearly finished painting. He wore his A2 jacket despite the day's unseasonable warmth. A sergeant stood just behind him, a dark, small man with black eyes.
"What, you got demoted?"
Brobin asked. Shorty shifted the brush to his left hand and gave the captain a casual salute.
trying to gauge whether he looked approving or disappointed as he took in the artwork.
I don't want to rush you, Shorty, Farley called up. But I think she'll be happier if she's dressed up when we take her to the dance.
So we're definitely going out tomorrow?
Everett asked. Farley raised an eyebrow.
I don't know anything you boys don't. But if the order does come down tonight, it's a safe bet we'll be on the roster.
If these guys will leave me alone, I'll have her done in half an hour, Cap, said Shorty. This crate will fly out with the best nose this side of Durante.
Farley smiled.
That's what I want to hear.
He glanced back at the new sergeant and waved him forward.
Gentlemen, this is Sergeant Proudhorse. He's our new ball gunner.
Proudhorse?
Brobin went to the trailing edge of the wing and slid off. He landed on the concrete with surprising grace for a man of his girth.
What kind of name is that?
Lakota, said the sergeant.
Brobin cocked his head. Beside him, Plavitz joggled the baseball in his hand.
Beats me, he told Brobin.
Proudhorse nodded to himself.
Indian,
he tried again.
Well, why didn't you say so in the first place? Drawled Wen.
He spat tobacco juice and held up a palm.
How, Chief?
The new man looked the flight engineer up and down. Beside Wen, Everett put his hands on his hips.
You left your teepee to come all the way to England and shoot Germans?
Proudhorse looked at him without expression. Then he pounded a fist against his chest.
Me heap big plane's engine, he said. Fly heap big planes. Drop 'em bomb. Make 'em smoke.
He looked up and opened his hands to the sky.
Send Nazi devils to happy hunting ground.
Everett stared. Proudhorse kept looking up. Shorty started laughing, and the crew took it up until they were whooping. Brobin grinned and stepped toward the new crew member.
The circus needs all the clowns it can get, he said.
He held out a hand.
Welcome aboard, Sergeant.
The new guy may have been small, but he had a hell of a grip.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
Jerry Brobin.
Brobin leaned in and lowered his voice.
There an Indian word for your name?
He asked. Proudhorse looked up at him and shrugged his shoulder. He really was a little guy, about as close to 4F as you could get and still qualify.
My first name's Martin, if that helps.
Martin.
Brobin shook his head.
Never mind. This bunch will hand you a nickname in about 2 minutes anyway, like it or not.
I'm used to that.
I guess so.
Hey, Chief,
called Garrett.
They play ball out there on the reservation? You know, baseball?
He mimed swinging a bat.
Some,
Martin admitted.
Well, don't worry. We'll show you. First, we gotta get you a glove.
Garrett held up his own and flexed it.
See?
Mine's Beckett.
Hey, Shorty!
Garrett called up.
Loan Geronimo here your glove, will you?
Shorty pointed with his brush.
It's by the wheel chalk there.
Garrett fetched the well-worn fielder's glove and held it out to Martin.
Your hand goes in this end, Chief.
Martin put on the glove and stood looking at it. Captain Farley looked as if he were about to say something, but changed his mind. Martin glanced at him, and Farley gave back a little smile and nodded.
Have fun, Sergeant, he said. That's an order.
Martin saluted with the glove.
Yes, sir.
Garrett jogged backward along the taxiway, away from the row of heavy bombers parked facing him. He nodded at Plavitz, and the navigator underhanded the baseball to Martin, who caught it in the trap and stood looking at Garrett. The burly waist gunner held his glove in front of his chest.
All right, Geronimo.
He punched the glove, then flapped it.
Put her anywhere around here, got it? Just pretend you're throwing a tomahawk.
Up on his ladder, Shorty shook his head. Being the new guy was hard enough without being the new guy and an Indian. He bent and mixed up more flesh pink and was just stretching up to start on the face when a loud pop nearly startled him from the ladder. It had sounded like a rifle shot. Garrett yelled and Everett hooted. Shorty turned as quickly as he could high up on the ladder and saw Garrett wringing his hand like he was trying to flick off snot.
His glove and the baseball lay in the grass beside him.
God damn it,
said Garrett. Everett put his hands on his knees and cackled. Wen laughed and slapped himself on the leg with his grimy cap. Brobin grinned like someone had told a dirty joke, and even Boney smiled there behind his great stinking bulldog briar pipe as he sat in the shade of the wing. The captain folded his arms and tried to look above it all. He almost succeeded. Martin remained in his follow-through, waiting to see what Garrett was going to do. The big man turned his hand in front of his face as if puzzled that there was no blood.
I think you broke it, he said. Son of a bitch feels like wood.
Martin straightened up and pointed to the trap on his glove.
It hurts less if you catch it here.
Screw you.
And the proud horse I rode in on,
Martin agreed. Everybody laughed harder, and Brobin applauded slowly. Sergeant Horse was a pitcher for the American Legion team in Rapid City, said Farley.
Post 22, South Dakota State champs, said Martin.
This just keeps getting better, said Brobin. You have a nickname when you played?
Martin looked embarrassed.
They, called me Red Man. Because I chewed tobacco.
Good thing you didn't like beech nut,
Shorty chimed in from on high. Everett chortled.
Hear that, Gus? Geronimo here is called Red Man. I don't give a shit if he's called General Jesus Roosevelt, said Garrett. He nearly gimped my goddamn hand.
You do all your pulling with the other one anyway,
said Everett.
Only when he sees an overstuffed couch,
added Plavitz. He drummed a rim shot on the hull. Shorty turned back to the riveted metal looming above him. Any other day, he'd be in the middle of the fun, cracking jokes and doing voices and pulling faces. But tomorrow, the aluminum he was painting would carry him across the English Channel or the North Sea in sub-zero temperatures, possibly through storms and definitely through enemy territory. It was thinner than the steel of a beer can, and it was all the shield he'd have between himself and fighter planes and anti-aircraft shells. That shield would bear his artwork, and it had to be right. Shorty came off like a goofball, but he was dead serious about his work. He was barely aware of what he was doing as he dipped a trim brush, borrowed from Corporal Brinkman, into half a beer can and pulled on the soft, slick bristle and finished up the figure's face, adding shades and highlights. Finally, Shorty gathered up his paint cans and climbed carefully from the ladder. He set down the cans and moved the ladder aside and stepped back and looked up at her, only dimly aware of his sore neck and aching back. The jibes and throws tossed all around him sounded underwater. There was just the parked bomber, angled as if already climbing in the air, the two small windows at the navigator station in the nose, the painted figure prone beneath. The setting sun cast magic hour light across the airfield. He became aware that someone was standing beside him, and he glanced at the captain. Farley wasn't smiling. He wasn't frowning. Shorty couldn't have said what the expression on his face was. Recognition, maybe? A man who saw some long-held notion given shape at last. Oh, said Farley. Ah, she's fine, Shorty. Really fine. Just the way I pictured. Reluctantly, he looked away from the painting. You've outdone yourself on this one.
Sir,
Shorty saluted. Garrett's wolf whistle broke the moment.
She can wave my wand anytime she wants, he said.
A little respect, huh? Said Brobin. That's a lady you're talking about.
The 10 of them were gathered around the front of the bomber now. Captain, co-pilot, navigator, bombardier, flight engineer. Left and right waist gunners, tail gunner, belly gunner. And Shorty, the radio operator, who glanced among their faces, looking for frowns, knitted brows, cocked heads. He didn't find any. Even the new guy was looking on in open admiration, though he couldn't have fully appreciated what he was seeing. The painting on the nose of the Flying Fortress showed a sorceress, not a witch, not a hag. A long, slim, pale-skinned woman in a skin-tight navy blue leotard. Long black hair and pale green eyes. She was posed like the figurehead on an old sailing ship,
were the hood ornament on a Cadillac. Nearly prone, back arched, one arm back and one outstretched and raven hair windswept, as if diving through the water or the air. Long pale legs, one bent at the knee. A gauzy blue cape flowed from her shoulders. A black wand in her outstretched hand pointed toward the 50 cal cheek gun emerging from a clear plexiglass window. She was long and angular and strong, joyous in her flight but determined in her attitude. Her face was stern and regal and refined. Not a grin, but the ghost of a smile. Her clear-eyed gaze was fixed on something beyond the aircraft, always looking ahead, always flying to meet it. This was no Betty Grable in a bathing suit, no girlish Vargas pinup. This was a Da Vinci angel, ethereal in metal, a waterhouse nymph, resplendent in flight, beautiful and refined. Magical and eerie, and not quite of this earth. In the background floated isolated clouds. Some of them looked oddly solid, like granite, and at least one looked suspiciously like a medieval castle. The lettering beneath the flying woman was shadowed script, almost a signature. Fata Morgana. The men were quiet, looking at her. Shorty realized that he had never once seen his crewmates together and quiet, except at mission briefings right before wheels up. It made him nervous. Then Garrett said,
"Still needs bigger tits."
Lieutenant Brobin took off his hat and rubbed his brush cut and sighed. He put an arm around Shorty and stood looking at the painting. "I apologize, ma'am," Brobin told the flying figure. "An angel could play the violin, and some guy would only hear a horse's tail sawing on a piece of catgut."
"Well, what else is it?" asked Garrett.
Brobin dropped his arm from Shorty and turned to Farley.
"I got an idea," he said. "Tomorrow, let's just drop Garrett on Germany. The Nazis will be finished in a week."
"I think it'd violate the Geneva Convention," said Farley. "There are some things you just can't do in a war, even the Nazis." Brobin sighed.
"Bombs it is, then. Like civilized men," Farley agreed.
Martin shook his head.
"I can't keep up with you guys," he said.
Boney pointed the stem of his pipe at the bomber.
"Keep up in there," he said.
Martin looked at the bombardier, tall and skinny and very pale, gaunt face impassive behind his fuming pipe. It was the first thing the man had said since Martin had arrived.
"Boney talks like he bombs," Shorty told him. "He doesn't drop one till he's sure it's gonna hit."
Martin pointed to the lettering.
"Fata Morgana?" he asked.
"Fata Morgana,"
Shorty corrected.
"What's it mean?"
"Tell him what it means, Joseph," said Brobin.
"Yeah, tell him, Cap," said Garrett. "I want to hear it again, too."
"Maybe it'll sink in this time," said Everett.
Garrett punched him on the shoulder.
"All right," said Farley.
He looked around self-consciously at his attentive crew, then nodded at his new belly gunner.
"Fata Morganas are a kind of mirage," he said.
"You see them under certain conditions in calm weather, when a layer of warm air sits on top of a layer of cold air. It acts like a lens. Sometimes they look like floating rocks just above the horizon." Farley paused. "Or castles in the air." Brobin waggled his eyebrows.
"Castles," he said. "In the air."
"Say,"
Shorty said in his best radio announcer voice.
"You mean like a flying fortress?"
"Why, yes, Sergeant. I mean exactly like a flying fortress. Clever, no?"
"But why not call her Mirage?" asked Martin. "Everyone knows what a mirage is."
"A Fata Morgana's a special kind of mirage," said Captain Farley. "Technically, it's a complex superior mirage." "Oh, you got the fancy flight school," said Brobin.
"The one for smart pilots," Farley agreed.
"So where does the girl with the magic wand come in?" Martin persisted.
"She's a girl," said Everett. "You need a reason?"
Morgan Le Fay was a sorceress in King Arthur, said Farley. She was Arthur's half-sister. Robin hooked a thumb at Farley. College boy, he explained. He mimed drinking tea with his pinky extended. Literature, don't you know? Farley nodded at the painting. The Italians called her Fata Morgana. They named the mirages after her because they thought they were magic. Floating islands or castles that lured sailors to their death, like the sirens.
Yeah, the air raid sirens, said Garrett.
Martin squinted at the woman on the bomber.
So, she's a sorceress, and a flying fortress, and a mirage?
Farley nodded. You've got it. Martin looked thoughtful as he rubbed near the hollow of his throat. His intensity made the men glance among themselves, but they said nothing.
The Lakota have Heoko Inyan, said Martin. Thunder-dreaming woman. She carries lightning, and she's a great healer. She speaks in a voice like thunder.
Well, this dame's gonna yell all over Germany when we take her up, said Brogan.
Fata Morgana,
Martin said again. Shorty nodded.
We weren't all that nuts about it at first, he said.
He ducked his head apologetically at Farley.
But after the captain explained it, it was kind of hard to picture calling her anything else.
Martin nodded.
Names have power, he said.
He became aware that they were all looking at him, and he spread his hands.
Hey, you don't need my okay,
he protested.
I'm the new guy.
Tomorrow's our first time with her, too, said Boney.
She'll be a good old girl,
said Wen.
Lady,
Robin countered. Garrett shrugged.
Girl, lady, I'm still gonna see how far I can get with her and still be friends.
Robin shook his head.
Sergeant Garrett, he said, you're a hell of a gunner, but you are 100% barbarian.
Whatever Garrett replied was drowned out by the crew's laughter.